This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks again for joining us to Landmark Women. For those few of you who don't know who I am, and I don't think that's any of you, I'm Frances Baldwin, and I'm looking after the museum friends here. If you're not familiar with the wonderful benefits of the museum friends, please talk to your colleagues who brought you along, or come and see us in the office if you're interested in joining, because it's a wonderful program. And this talk is one of the highlights that we have every month. A reminder that the session is being recorded and Polly's also transcribing here, so please wait for, turn your phones off first of all, or on silent, and wait for the microphones for questions at the end. I also want to let you know that you would have noticed the Defining Moments event that's happening down in the hall this morning. It starts in about 30 minutes, so when the session is over, if you could just either go through the shop or probably around the bay window just to avoid all that congestion in the hall, and I apologise if that's inconvenient for anybody. Come and see me if you need assistance. Now, to introduce our speaker for March, Heather Reid, AM, has been involved with football or soccer since 1978. She has worked as several senior management and consultancy positions and has been a lecturer in sports admin at the University of Canberra. Since 2004, Heather has been the CEO of ACT Football Federation, otherwise known as Capital Football, and she's in her eighth year wearing a second hat as the CEO of the Westfield W League Champions, Canberra United FC. Heather was appointed to the board of the 2015 Asian Cup Local Organising Committee and was also on the ACT Steering Committee. Canberra hosted seven games in the Asian Cup in January this year, with more than 82,000 people supporting the event in Canberra, which is wonderful. She is also an executive member of the ACT Olympic Council. Most recently, Heather was awarded a Member of the Order of Australia in the 2015 Australia Day Awards, so congratulations on that, for her significant service to sports admin and as an advocate for gender equality in sport. So please welcome me in joining Heather to Landmark Women.
Thank you very much, Frances. And thank you very much for inviting me to speak this morning. Some people would say, oh, I love talking about myself, but I particularly love talking about women in sport and the journey that I've had, especially through football. Before I start, some of you may have seen a bit of my presentation. I also spoke at the wonderful Friends of the National Library and did a similar presentation. Was anybody at that talk who was here? Okay, so I do need to warn you that there is a little bit of graphic nudity in some of my slides, so be forewarned. And I also want to say we're talking about football and we're talking about the round ball game, the world game of soccer. I often say to people, let's not get hung up about whether we call it football or soccer. It's the world game. There are many forms of football, rugby league, rugby union, Aussie rules, touch, and soccer. So if I'm talking about football, I'm also talking about soccer, so that's pretty clear. So what I'm going to do today is tell you a little bit about myself and the part that I've played in the evolution and progress of women's involvement in football, particularly in Canberra, over the last 35 years. It's about the role I played in the unification of four organisations into a single entity known as Capital Football, or the ACT Football Federation, which represents the interests of more than 18,000 male and female players in Canberra, playing football and futsal, five-a-side, seven-a-side, nine-a-side, etc., 12 months of the year now, as well as thousands of coaches, referees, club administrators and volunteers, and I'm sure that every one of you in this room knows somebody who has some connection with the sport of soccer. It's fair to say that the progress of opportunities for women in sport in Australia, and particularly fairly male-dominated sports like football, and indeed across the world, have never really been straightforward or uncontested. Gains made in one generation, and we have several generations in this room, can quickly be lost in the next, and we see the demise of separate women's associations that existed up until probably the 1960s that have now become part of integrated umbrella organisations that we now have. Has changed the landscape quite a bit for women in sport. But real change has only occurred when individuals or organisations have challenged the way the system works. to ensure that the changes are sustainable and they're equitable and they're fair. So my story is also somewhat of a success story. It relates to how careful and at times fairly courageous and crazy decisions, combined with the willingness of lots of parties to work together to compromise and collaborate, has led to a better sport for everyone. But first, a little bit about me. So I'm the daughter of working-class Scottish migrants who came from Edinburgh in Scotland to Australia in 1955 with my older brother and sister. I was born the following year in Goulburn. We ended up in Goulburn because my maternal grandmother was there. She was the first to come to Australia with her daughter, my mother's younger sister, essentially to care for one of her sons who was in the British Navy and had been offloaded on the boat in Darwin because he was sick and ended up in Sydney. My grandmother ended up in Goulburn working for the Archbishop there in the church. So from Goulburn, where my father worked as a plumber and my mother was a hairdresser, we moved after a year or so. Well, my father actually moved, first of all, to Cooma to work on the Snowy Mountain scheme. And he lived in Cooma without his family for probably 18 months. And he travelled from Cooma to Canberra to Goulburn every weekend to be with his family in Goulburn. So I never really saw very much of my father when I was a baby, other than maybe on a Friday night and the weekends, and he was off again on Monday morning. But we grew up in Cooma, Kankoban and Talbingo, and if you know the Snowy Mountains area, it's absolutely beautiful country and a great experience. And I'm talking about the 1960s, 70s and 80s particularly. And in those towns, we know that that area is often referred to as the birthplace of multicultural Australia. The Snowy Mountains hydroelectric scheme, what an amazing, amazing change for Australia that has had such an impact on everything that we do in many respects. So in many respects, I was a country kid sheltered from the city. I didn't really know too much about Wild Music, Uriah Heep, you know, Cream, Deep Purple, all those sort of 70s rock bands, etc. Didn't come to my life unless people came into the township with their music and whatever else, or we listened to it on the radio at night time when we got good reception from a Sydney station. But I also didn't really understand too much about what was going on around me in terms of the Snowy Mountains scheme. I knew that there were being dams built and people were being relocated from their homes and that there were tunnels and all this sort of stuff, but I really didn't have much of an appreciation about what the Snowy Mountains scheme was all about until a primary school headmaster, when I was in sixth grade, asked the question, what is the Snowy Mountains scheme? And there was only one kid in the class that knew. So it was a big education for us. We were just living and breathing this amazing kind of lifestyle. So I have very fond memories of the freedom and wonderful outdoor life that we had during those years. And on reflection, mixing with kids who had names like Krapinski, Levisianus, Aglitas, Matachevsky, Brown, Brewis, Murphy, they all helped give me a great appreciation of the diversity and richness of our society. Different music, different food, culture, recreation and sport. In my teenage years, I travelled to high school in Tumut on the bus that picked up kids along the way from the farms, kids who were later displaced from their homes to make way for the Blowering Dam. And in this diaspora, I also had friends who were third or fourth generation Australians, as well as Aboriginal, Chinese, Japanese, French and German kids who came with their families to build part of the Snowy Mountains scheme. I was educated in small primary schools with often one teacher. I remember the first day in Talbingo was in a house and we were in one room and there were 14 kids and one teacher. Eventually grew to a much larger primary school. We played Vigora, you probably remember that, field hockey, we did athletics, and we spent most of our summer holidays swimming or just lazing around the lake and the river. My dad built a boat, which meant we also enjoyed sailing, and there was always a lot of fishing without much reward, other than the pleasure of fishing. On the weekends, I did housework, and I also worked at the local service station pumping petrol for pocket money. My mum worked in Tumut on the Thursday, Friday, Saturday as a hairdresser to earn extra money. So as the third child and somebody who didn't mind doing a bit of housework, I looked after the house on the Saturday and quickly shooed people out the door if they came in to make a mess. I cleaned silver for a wonderful Scottish woman called Mrs. Andine, who regarded me as a sensible girl with a lovely disposition. And I did babysitting for money, but also for the opportunity to learn how to type. a skill that stood me in great stead ever since. I type in every single aspect of my job. I don't have a PA in what I do. I am the typist, and I type pretty fast, and I can type while I'm still talking to somebody. The staff find it amazing. But that skill is something that I think is a fundamental skill now, particularly in the computer age. So it was a great life for a kid who loved heading into the mountains and the bush on a Saturday. I'd join with friends, we'd get a billy, we'd get some tea, we'd have a sausage or something, and we'd go up and we'd make a little fire, probably illegally, and we'd boil the billy and we'd have a great time. But it was also there that I was introduced to association football or soccer, as the men from the barracks or the camp played in local league. We had something like 3,000 men living in single quarters. They came from all over the world, mainly from Europe, as migrants from southern Europe in particular. They played in the locals league on Saturday. And it was also there that I was introduced to the cultural and political differences between some of these men who were from migrant Europes. In particular, I learnt that not all people from the former Yugoslavia were actually Yugoslavians. They were Croatian, Serbian, Albanian, Macedonian, of course, Bosnian, and many other nationalities. And unbeknown to me at the time, those experiences have helped me greatly with my work in football, the multicultural sport of Australia. And from those days, more than 40 years ago, I would never have thought, never imagined that I'd go on to have such a long involvement in this world game from when I first saw it when I was 12 or 13. So I came to Canberra in 1974 after I finished school, and I came to do a secretarial course at what was then the TAFE College on Constitution Avenue. And after working in the public service as a typist, I decided it was time to head overseas. I was 20 years of age and I wanted to go and meet my parents' families, my paternal grandmother, my aunts, uncles and cousins who were in Scotland and Canada. So I spent 10 months travelling overseas, meeting and staying with these wonderful people. And that terrific experience certainly gave me a growing up experience in my life. I had my 21st birthday in Olympia, Washington. I shoveled snow in Canada at Christmas time, and I hold all of that very dear to my Scottish heritage. I still cry when I hear the bagpipes. When I returned, I worked as a secretary at the ANU, where I met women who were playing at lunchtime in a lunchtime soccer competition. And before long, I was cajoled into getting involved and have been hooked ever since. We formed the ANU Women's Club and then the ACT Women's Soccer Association. And that was part of the Australian Women's Soccer Association. And we did that because whilst initially women's soccer in Canberra was played under the former Canberra Junior League, we really wanted to determine our own destiny and have our own decision-making, and we were kind of accepted by the men, but really it was a little bit of lip service. And we felt, we're talking about the 70s, you know, the feminist generation, etc., we could do it ourselves. I managed the ACT representative team in the first year, and I found myself at national meetings where it wasn't long before I was appointed to the board as well as to the position of a national team manager. It seems I had a lot to say about the management and the future of the sport and where we might go, so I quickly developed a reputation as an advocate for creating more opportunities and change for women in this fairly male-dominated area. So with a taste for sports administration and a secretarial background and a planner and an organiser and a doer, I enrolled in what was the first sports management course at the Canberra College of Advanced Education, now the University of Canberra, in 1981. And this course was set up essentially for the athletes at the AIS who had to do some study or go to school. Obviously, I wasn't an elite athlete at the AIS or a coach, but I got into the second semester as a mature age student, and I was one of the first graduates in the sports administration course in 1983. From there, I went on to be CEO of ACT Touch Football Association, and then 2 years later, I got my dream job as the only employee of the Australian Women's Soccer Association, the first position that they created. I stayed there for 6 years before working for Women's Sport Australia, a national lobby group for women in sport, the Australian Sports Commission and the University of Canberra. So from my beginnings at club and state level and with a formal education in sport management in 1986, there I was in my dream job working and getting paid to do something about improving opportunities for women in soccer. I had an IBM typewriter, I had a fax machine and no other technology apart from the phone and no mobile phone. What a lovely time that was compared to now. But it was my job to guide the organisation from what is often known as the kitchen table administration to the national and international boardroom. And also develop strong competitions, strong club competitions across Australia that fed into state and national championships. Participation by women and girls increased over those years, and on my trips overseas with the national team, prior to the national team being regarded as the Matildas, I realised the importance of developing professional networks, firstly in Oceania and then in Asia, and then using them to reach further internationally into football. I was part of a small group of people who lobbied FIFA to introduce a World Cup for women. And with strong support from the USA in particular, over the past 23 years, we've seen the introduction of a World Cup for women in 1991, Under-20s World Cup, Under-17s World Cup, more importantly from a funding point of view, the Olympic football tournament for women, and of course, more recently, with our inclusion in the Asian Football Confederation, an Under-14 Asian competition as well, and massive complex qualification processes for our national women's teams in order to make the World Cup. The Australian women's team is ranked number 10 in the world. They're off to Canada in June, where they'll play in the sixth World Cup. I'm going to be taking a month off and going and joining them. But this now is the sport that has the most opportunities on a world level for women in terms of team sport. As the stakes for women in football began to change, I tried to ensure that the amateur nature of sport also changed across the whole spectrum. I saw the need for Australian players to gain international experience and exposure. I negotiated the first international contracts for Australian female players, and one of those players was from Canberra, and it's Julie Murray, who played in Denmark. I also recognised that further systemic change was needed for the sport to be truly sustainable and competitive. And to these ends, I've been an advocate of opportunities for women in leadership roles. It's very dear to my heart that we have to do something to get more women into leadership. Sport is a reflection of society. We see this lack of women in leadership in so many areas of society and industry, and sport is no different to women in education or women in agriculture and et cetera. Also, I want to make sure that we promote mentoring programs, and I'm very happy to mentor to, you know, inspiring leaders, male and female, as they go on their journey through sports management. Gone are the times when I'd personally phone or fax the media with results of international games. I now get calls from the Canberra Times on a frequent basis, chasing me for stories. The latest one is who's going to be the new coach of Canberra United. We'll tell you next week. I closely monitor the quality and quantity of media coverage of sport, and it's such a pity that really not much has changed in 20 or 30 years. It's still less than 3% newspaper coverage for women's sport in the media. That's another story. This is a little poster that I produced back in the 1980s, and you'll see the difference between this and what came 20, 30 years later. But you know, get your kicks from soccer because it is a sport for all. But I left the AWSA in 1992 when it seemed that the days of separate women's associations were numbered, and I'd simply run out of energy. I just couldn't cope anymore with the battles against sexism, misogyny and a whole range of other little things that were going on, and I really needed to take a break. So after nearly 12 years of a break, which really I never really stepped too far away from because I continued to play and coach at community level, I found myself being wooed back into administration. And as you've heard from Francis, for the past 11 years, I've been CEO of the ACT Football Federation. It's the biggest sport in Canberra, and I also, 7 years ago, got the opportunity to head up Canberra United, which is a program of Capital Football. Canberra United is the benchmark club in the W League. We're the only standalone team without an A-League team. FFA gave us the licence with confidence that Capital Football could finance it and manage it. And I think we've proven with two championships in 7 years and two premierships on top of that, that we're doing a pretty good job. So I'm the only female in such a position, and I'm the longest serving of 9 state federation CEOs, which means that more often than not, I'm the only female sitting at the board table with my male colleagues, and sometimes that can be 10, 15, 20, 25 people in the room. But don't worry, I can hold my own with them, and they know not to mess too much. And that comes from information, that comes from knowledge, that comes from history, that comes from just being in the game. But over the past decade, the last 10 years particularly, we've seen tremendous change in football, much needed transformational change. And it's evident with everything that we do in capital football. And despite the piles of reports that called for reform in the sport prior to 2001, very few were effective in bringing about change compared to this independent federal government-initiated report released by David Crawford in 2003. There were 53 recommendations in this report that reflected the totality of soccer's problems. They included cronyism, nepotism, mismanagement, incompetence, lack of mutual trust, and power struggles. Why would anybody want to get involved with that? Change was vital for the sport's sheer survival and future success, and part of that change involved amalgamating the scores of associations responsible for the game. So what was talked about before was now a reality, and recommendation 26 clearly articulated what needed to be done. So as I said before, prior to the Crawford Report, Australian Women's Soccer was looking at a merger with the Australian Soccer Federation, without knowing the extent of the problems within that organisation. Around the same time, the association experienced a premature collapse due to a range of peculiar and potentially fraudulent circumstances. It's fair to say that the CEO of Australian Women's Soccer at the time led the board up the garden path, and we had no idea that we were close to trading insolvent. There were only four separate independent state associations in 2003, which meant that there was no obvious leadership. And the ACT Association that I'd helped form was one of those four. So this recommendation that says that existing state federations basically needed to amalgamate with Soccer Australia. Under trying circumstances from 1974 until 2002, women's football had made great progress. The women's associations had government recognition, as well as funding and participation was growing. But in reality, however, there was no official recognition by Soccer Australia or FIFA of the women's associations. Even entry to the World Cup qualification tournaments had to go through FIFA. And whilst we knew that this kind of recommendation or this path was inevitable, nobody actually said how to make it happen. And this had been going for 15 years. How do you make this amalgamation happen? That's another story that I don't want to bore you with how it happened, but we went through a fairly rigorous process. And then I think we move forward to the late 1990s, or we go just a little bit before this, to the late 1990s. There was some series of events that significantly changed the face of football, and particularly that for women. Interventions and public comments changed the profile of women's football in unprecedented ways. These included the head of FIFA at the time, Sepp Blatter, he's still there, declaring that the future of football is feminine. After the huge success of the 1999 World Cup in the USA, which had a sellout crowd of 60,000 spectators, and the World Cup in Canada is already, every single game will be sold out with anything from 50,000 to 80,000 spectators at every game. Popular culture was also instrumental in changing attitudes with movies like Bend It Like Beckham, and I bet you've seen this many times, most of you with grandchildren, time and time again. But Bend It Like Beckham had a huge impact on young girls and women, and also no doubt on boys. And then, no doubt, programs from the first Women's World Cup in China in 91, and also then in 2007. But this particular controversial and somewhat startling Australian team calendar in 1999 also took the game to new heights in Australia and across the globe. The Matildas calendar, I'm probably sure you've all heard of it, you've probably not all seen it, but I bet your husbands or your brothers or your uncles have seen it. The Matildas calendar featuring cover girl Amy Taylor, also from Canberra, now a very successful TV presenter as Amy Duggan on WIN TV. Amy's probably the only player that's really made a career out of her football reputation, but also being a very competent news presenter. So Amy Taylor on your left. And also Australia's most capped player, male or female, Cheryl Salisbury. This particular calendar, you will see it heralded the new fashion in football, the Matildas, the new fashion in football. And whether or not we agree with the approach taken by the players to let the public see that they were actually real women and not men in disguise, there's no doubt it brought international recognition and changed attitudes towards the female player that were never realised in the previous 20 years. I should say that there was no marketing strategy associated with this calendar. I was on the board at the time and I did not agree with the release of it, but the players wanted to do it, and they wanted to do it to show people that they were actually real women. And I'm not sure... There you go. They're real women. So by stripping off and using the sex sells marketing strategy, the players were essentially reaching out to a particular audience to reduce the unwarranted stereotyping, discrediting and marginalising of the female player. And this was a far cry from that first poster that I showed you of 1993, who told us to get our kicks from soccer because it was a sport for all. So when I was appointed CEO of Soccer Canberra in early 2004 and became the first woman to lead an organisation with responsibility for men's and junior football as well as referees and coaching, it didn't include women's participation. According to some people, I'd gone to the dark side. I was selling out on my sisters and I might as well have been working with the enemy. It was a tough time the first few years. I had to do a management restructure. We had to start the integration process with the help of ACT government and a facilitator. That's now history. But some people just didn't understand or get how a woman could fill such a position. One of my first tasks was to bring Soccer Canberra, Women's Soccer Canberra, ACT Futsal and the Referees Association together with the aim of forming a single entity, now known as Capital Football. What I was intent on doing was making sure that it was a new entity and it wasn't one taking over the other, and that there was recognition for all elements of the football family. So a new governance structure combined with a new management framework and the adoption of a new brand for football were vital instruments in persuading the parties to work together. And whilst the job was daunting, it would take years to make it all happen. And one of the hardest things that I had to deal with, and I think this happens a lot in business if you're working for an organisation, particularly in Canberra, if you're working for the government, is that conflict between your own personal views and your professional or business obligations. What you have to do from a business point of view, because there are directives from somewhere, compared to how you feel personally. And there was very little room for compromise or deviation from national or my own board's directives. In particular, I had to negotiate with the Women's Association that I'd been instrumental in forming 25 years ago, that they had to give up their autonomy and they had to engage with partners that they probably didn't trust. Remember the cronyism, nepotism, etc., that was highlighted before. It also required the Women's Association to start working inside the tent rather than outside on the fringe. And so negotiating a compromise and looking forward to a better future under the new model and brand was always foremost in my mind. And then in 2005, Soccer Canberra then became Capital Football. We were the first association to adopt a new national model constitution and we launched ACT Football Federation, old soccer, new football. We had an memorandum of understanding with the other parties involved, the futsal and referees. We identified risks and we identified treatments of those risk timelines, etc., that I won't get into now. But in 2007, Women's Soccer Canberra, the former ACT Women's Soccer Association, voted to wind up its business, acknowledging that women's participation was stronger and better resourced than they'd expected to be under the new federation. And whilst this was a particularly sad meeting for me personally, I was confident that the women's game had the capacity to mature into an equitable part of the football family in the near future. And I was also determined not to sort of, you know, toss the baby out with the bathwater. It was simply a matter of refreshing that bathwater and helping the baby grow. So 8 years after we started the integration process, all components of the football family are together. We've grown from having 5 staff in 2004 to 18 staff this year. I manage budgets of last financial year was just over $4 million. We had a $183,000 surplus. We have over $1 million in reserve. Compared to when I started with Soccer Canberra and the organisation was close to insolvency. Change is ongoing in so many areas of our business, and of significance is the inclusion of Canberra United in the Westfield W League, something that I'm personally very proud of, and as I said, I'll wear their second hat. So as my mother would say, you work 24/7, Heather, when do you get time to have a break? Well, I'm going to take a month off, as I said, in June. But Canberra United was a major achievement because the W League is based on the A League model, and we don't have an A League team in Canberra. But we were able to convince FFA, as I mentioned before, that we had the capacity to sustain a Canberra women's team. We'd previously been in the National Soccer League. We'd won it many times. We had a large number of players in the national team, and we knew we could do it. But we don't have an A-League team, and there are really a number of reasons for that. But if you have a look at this little poster, this was the first poster for the National Women's League. It was football with style. So we've gone from get your kicks from soccer to the new fashion in football to now football with style. To me, they look like some might call chicks on the disco dance floor. But, you know, it seemed to resonate apparently, particularly with girls from 8 years old to maybe 13. That was the marketing campaign, a little bit more of sex sells in a slightly different way. I don't see too many players with the makeup like those players, but they were real players. They are real players. Grace Gill in the green from Canberra United. It's interesting, though. We don't have an A-League team, and just because you're here, I'd need to tell you, not because we're complacent and we can't manage this, but I do often have to explain why we don't have a team in the National Men's League. And the main reason is that FFA hasn't given us a licence. And they haven't given us a licence because it requires community and private ownership, with around $8 million per year now to sustain a licence. So we know how the Brumbies and the Raiders and other teams in national leagues have struggled in this town. But, you know, in terms of being able to sustain it in a longer-term sense, that's a big ask. And when FFA does expand the A-League, probably in 2017, 2018, I can't see that Canberra's going to have an A-League team. And this is not a gender issue, it's simply a commercial reality. We don't have the population to sustain a licence. Anyway, through collective efforts, we built Canberra United, and there's a certain amount of jealousy around that, I can tell you. A lot of men in this town don't like the idea that we have a women's team, but we don't have a men's. But anyway, we run it in a very progressive and professional way. We've been front page news with the alleged ultimatum given to Elise Perry to make a decision between cricket and football. We never asked her to choose cricket or football. We just said, you're playing cricket in Sydney, football in Canberra, one of them has to go. We led the way with the appointment of highly qualified coaches from overseas. I was the first CEO to appoint a pro-licensed international coach from Czech Republic, and then more recently a coach from Holland. We now have an opportunity to appoint a local coach who's been mentored by both those coaches. And, of course, we attract quality media and sponsorship support, particularly from September through to February. So my journey in football has been quite remarkable, and it's also been rewarding. My job keeps me busy, as I've noted, and I oversee all aspects of competition management for men, women, juniors, futsal, all commercial operations, all business operations, all high-performance programs. And I can tell you at times it's tough. It's definitely tough. This makes a little bit of difference. It's tough when personal, abusive and mischievous attacks are directed at me in an attempt to destabilise or turn me in a different direction, maybe enforce my resignation. Some of you may have read the Canberra Times article last year about the abusive bullying and harassment that I get in some areas of social media. And the frustrating thing is that there's just nothing we can do about that except ignore it, which is tough. But the kinds of comments are very different from the troublemaker label that once was thrown at me when, in my earlier years, when I was striving for equity, inclusion and respect for the diversity rather than accepting the status quo. And overall, I don't mind the troublemaker label because unless you cause a bit of trouble, you don't make change. So for the past 3 years, as Francis mentioned, I've also been on the organising committee for the Men's Asian Cup, just in case people think I don't do anything for men's football, which saw seven fantastic games played here in Canberra. The most successful venue, the most successful game was Iran versus Iraq with a full stadium. Phenomenal success, which will bring 12.9 million surplus and hopefully a little bit of return to Canberra and capital football or infrastructure in Canberra as well. And the success of that tournament, and especially the part that we played in Canberra, is something that I'm very proud of. As I'm also proud of the fact that Canberra United won the seventh season of the W League, with the player in the middle there, Laurie Lindsay, a USA veteran and a terrific role model for others. She chose to spend her final year playing football in Canberra with Canberra United, and it was great honour for her to take home a championship medal. So since 1978, when my journey began as a player, and I've moved through the years as a manager and a coach and a mentor administrator, a leader, a troublemaker, I hope I've enabled many other women and girls to realise their potential through physical activity and sport. And also, despite once being described as a formidable woman, which I wasn't quite sure what that meant, but I think it was supposed to be a compliment, I'd like to think that I've inspired and provided hope for others to enjoy their participation, to take strategic action off the field to be a change agent, and to make the environment and culture of sport a better place for all. And finally, I wondered where we'd be if our great mother, great-great-grandmothers hadn't followed their dreams in the first place. Thank you. 1894. Thank you very much. So very happy to take questions if you would like. Yeah.
How do you finance all this?
The bread and butter of the business comes from registered players. So registrations at nearly 18,000 represents probably close to two-thirds of our budget. So every player in Canberra who plays soccer contributes some registration fee to Capital Football. They pay a fee to their club and the club pays a fee to us. On top of that, we probably get around about $400,000 from Football Federation Australia, maybe $100,000 from the ACT government. The sponsorships for Canberra United are around about $180,000 to $200,000, and gate receipts and program sales as well. But the bread and butter is growing the business and growing participation. The challenge that we have now is that we're almost at capacity. We have very few places to play. Our indoor game is at capacity. There are the high demand in North Canberra, particularly for futsal. We're turning teams away. This year, on the back of the Men's World Cup last year and the Asian Cup, we have another 9 men's teams that want to play. Now, 9 men's teams, that means we go to 12 divisions, that's 120 teams of men's masters, men's open, plus 4 divisions of masters, plus 8 divisions of Premier League football. It's huge and continues to grow.
That is huge.
Yeah. So the difference, I guess, to compare, if volleyball, for example, volleyball might have, say volleyball's got 2,000 registered players. 2,000 registered players, you would have to charge 2,000 registered players maybe $500 to make 100,000. Is that right? So say it's got 2,000, two fives are 10. Yeah, we've got 18,000, so we don't have to charge the players that much. Our fees haven't gone up very much in the last 5 years at all. I think our fees for a junior player are around about $65, and then the club puts their fees on top of it. So it's a numbers game.
Congratulations. I think that's marvellous. And as the other football leagues and whatever have taken their sport to the outback, has soccer, football done that as well?
Yeah, football is very big in rural and regional areas. I don't think we engage the Indigenous population to the same extent as, say, Aussie Rules does at the national level. But, you know, Northern Territory has obviously very high populations of Indigenous players. I tell my colleagues, my interstate colleagues, that I'm actually a little bit lucky compared to them because I really only look after a big city and a region. New South Wales has got 10 or 15 of us. You know, so Capital Football is about the size of Blacktown region or Canterbury region or Illawarra, whatever. So, you know, we're able to do a lot of things much easier than the colleagues because we're in face-to-face contact with people every day almost. I can go to the ground. I do go to games on the weekends and I'm, you know, talking and meeting with our constituents and I'm hearing from them. Sometimes I don't go because I need a break from it. But you know, my colleagues in Perth or Sydney, et cetera, just can't have that same contact. But I can tell you that we have about 150 Indigenous kids registered that identify as Indigenous registered in our books. Regional areas for us include Yass, Goulburn, Cooma, Braidwood, Gundaroo, Jindabyne. That's how far we go. We're not just within this designated boundary of the ACT.
Anybody else like to ask a question?
If Thanks, Heather. I was just wondering whether the women from Canberra United are paid to play and if they have jobs as well and how they manage and balance that out with their play.
That's a good question. Some people think they get paid a lot, but they don't. We have a sliding scale that I base on a fairly standard industrial model of professional sport. The rookies get it $500 a season. So that means from August to last season started earlier in order to accommodate the Asian Cup. And so we started pre-season in August and it was all done and dusted before Christmas. So, 5 months, 4 months. $500 for the rookie, up to $7,000 for the highest paid player. So they work, they study, and they combine their training. For the international players, and we had four Anna books, we're obliged to make sure that we cover their return airfares and provide them with accommodation and a small allowance. So I scrambled to get well-meaning, nice families to look after the players, and I pay them $200 a week. So they don't come to play for the money. They come to play for the experience and the love of the game, which is a long way from where the men's game is at. So if we had an A-League team, the players would be expecting, $100,000 to play. So that's hence the budget goes out. The salary cap for the A-League, I think, is $2.1 million. So my total salary bill for the players is about $55,000. And the coach also, despite rumour and talk around town, the coach comes from overseas for $20,000, plus accommodation and travel. So they really shouldn't have to pay for too much. They get a meal every day at the AIS. So their main meal is at lunchtime. They're out on the training field at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the evening, and then they have something light in the evening. So $15 a day for all you can eat at the AIS is what keeps them going. And a bit of muesli at my place when they start at my place.
You mentioned that about 3% of newspaper coverage is for females. My feeling is Canberra Times would be higher than that, and certainly on 666, Tim Gavel seems to give very high coverage of women's sport.
Yeah. I think radio is much better, and radio is really powerful. I mean, I'll get on the radio as often as I can because what you say is immediate. You can control the message and it's not diluted. In the Canberra Times, they are certainly the leading newspaper when it comes to women in sport, and especially in summer. We have a unique situation in Canberra where we have the Canberra Capitals, Canberra United, the Canberra Meteors and the cricket, all playing in national leagues in the summertime, and we don't have any men's teams in that same space other than more recently the Cavalry. So they want content. And we celebrate, and this is a deliberate title, we celebrate the summer of women's sport by working together with cricket and basketball to promote women's participation in sport. I prefer to call it women in sport or sport for women rather than women's sport because it's sport, it's football, it's hockey, it's basketball. We don't talk about men's basketball or men's hockey or men's cricket, so we have to change the language a little bit. But all of the data from every single season of the W League shows that Canberra Times is way ahead of any other newspaper in terms of its coverage for sport and Canberra United in particular. The trouble that we have at the moment is in relation to TV coverage, and you would have seen the federal government's impact of budget cuts on ABC and hopefully not SBS too much, but the ABC has said they're going to cut the live coverage of the basketball and the football on the weekends in the summer. That would be tragic. That would affect our bottom line. That would affect our sponsorship because the sponsors come because they can have their brand on TV every Saturday afternoon or every second Saturday afternoon. It's about advertising and the commercial reality again. I'm hoping that the FFA will be able to do something for a broadcast deal because you and my mum and everybody else around town that likes to watch TV on a Saturday afternoon loves to see the W League at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock. And I like to record it and rewatch it when I get home. So that's vital. I think basketball's in a more difficult position with that and the media coverage. Basketball, the men's national league is not going strong. In fact, Andrew Gaze came out recently and said they should just scrap the whole lot and start again. Whereas the A-League is going strong, the Socceroos, the Matildas, there's always something happening in football. So the media coverage is interesting. But it is improving, I think, for us.
Any more questions?
A general question about the games. Are rules changing? Are different games evolving to eliminate injuries? Things like touch footy never used to be around years ago, for example.
Mm. I think a lot of that is the management of the games and who's in control of the games. Who is in control of the game? Often if you have the referee, then it's up to the referee to make sure the games are played within the rules of the game. Football should be a non-contact sport, but if you watch the games, it's certainly not, especially at the national level and the international level. I think for kids, the game has changed a lot. So for kids from four-year-olds through to 12s, they play 4-a-side, 7-a-side, 9-a-side, and then they don't start playing 11-a-side until they're 12. So that's really important, and that means that, you know, kids are more involved, but it also helps with the safety. We like to think that soccer is the safe football compared to league and union, where you really do have the physical contact as part of the game, and touch as well. Touch is, you know, you've got to have a physical contact. But at the top level, at the state level, I think it's really about how the game is managed and making sure that you stamp out that foul play or dangerous, reckless play. I don't play Masters anymore. I don't know if there's anybody in the room playing. We're very proud of having an over 35s women's competition. It's not too late to learn. It's not too late to play. The over 35s is what I call the born agains. They're not necessarily women who have played the game and then all of a sudden hit 35 and go into that division. They are mums, their aunties, their grandmums, their partners. They want to just play the game because they've watched their kids or watched their friends playing. But I don't really play it myself, A, because it's, I don't have much time and I never get away from the game, but there are some uncoordinated people that just run into you. I have a greater sense of self-preservation these days.
I'm just wondering, Heather, is it much being done in a strategic way to encourage women into management roles in sport?
Not enough. There's... there was a national women's leadership program that's managed through the Australian Sports Commission, and I have to say I've been fortunate to have a scholarship, a rolling three-year scholarship from that program. In the first year, I was able to use the funding to do the Australian Institute of Company Directors course, which I highly recommend. I can never really read a financial statement, but it's absolutely critical to the work that you do. So the company director's course, I then went to a conference in Copenhagen the following year, and last year I went to Helsinki for a conference, and all of that is about improving knowledge and learning, et cetera, networking, having a good time. But there's not enough happening in football, and that's where my next journey will, I hope, take me. I can tell you now I don't really want to be here in this position in another year's time. I've pretty much... done my job, but I want to be able to work with FIFA and the AFC, Asian Football Confederation, on leadership and management. There are great programs for women to become referees, and you know there's a whole host of women travelling around the world running coaching courses for women, but there's no separate coaching courses or for, you know, management and leadership courses, and we're crying out for that.
There's a fair amount of information now about the danger to brains from gridiron, from other sports where the brain hits the skull.
Mm.
Is there any move to take headers out of soccer?
I'd love to see it removed from the junior game. I'd love to see... You're right. I think no player should be hitting the ball until they're 18 or 20. And even then, you know... I don't think there's been as much research done on brain-related injuries in soccer as a result of hitting the ball as there is obviously in the contact sport like gridiron and league and union. And the work that Peter Fitzsimons, for example, keeps, promoting in terms of concussion and the dangers of that. There are very strong concussion rules in soccer. So Ashley Sykes, for example, one of our best, quickest players, had a concussion in one match. She wasn't allowed to play for another 3 games. So the medical requirements are very strong, and we have great medical staff supporting that. It's interesting that many, many years ago, FIFA introduced the compulsory wearing of shin guards. All right? Everybody has to wear shin guards. And I think this came about because of the rise of, you know, leg clashes and potential bleeding and the whole transmission of HIV/AIDS. But they've done nothing about head cuts. You know, you get up to head a ball and there's another player there and you clash heads, you can have just as much an impact. But I don't think we're going to see the day where players are wearing helmets. Some people do wear a kind of a soft padded helmet, with permission from the authorities, or a headband. But even then, FIFA controls everything. Those godly men in Zurich control everything in terms of what can you wear. And here's another issue that, you know, the uniform rules apply equally to people in Canberra as they do to Alaska and, you know, Norway and England and Hawaii, etc. So, you know, long pants or tracksuit pants or a long sleeve shirt, something that, I mean, men do wear long sleeve shirts, but it's always the shorts and the stockings. They call them stockings. Referees have to wear a long sleeve shirt and shorts. You know, in Canberra in winter, that doesn't make sense. Anyway.
Any more questions for Heather?
One more?
I was going to say, what are you going to do with the increasing population and lots of multinationals coming to Canberra if you're already at capacity? Where will you find more room and more resources?
We continue to work with the government on new facilities. We continue to diversify the products, so we try and do more. We can't play Monday to Friday because it's dark and we don't have grounds that have got adequate lighting for matches. It's adequate lighting for training, but we've just introduced an 11 o'clock time slot on Saturday for men. Traditionally, the men's leagues have been 1 o'clock and 3 o'clock. Now that we've gone to 11 o'clock, and I think this year we're introducing another one at 9 o'clock to cater for that extra division. So it's squeezing more into the weekend. Friday night football as well is sort of taking off for one of the Masters divisions, but there are a few places, as I said, that we can play on a Friday, but we just have to sneak into New South Wales.
I'd love to watch football now. The Asian Cup did something very special.
Very good.
And I was just thinking of your remarks about helmets and the way those people bounce that ball off their head. It's just fascinating.
It's a technique. It is a proper technique.
Stay down, like Irish dancing arms stay down.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it seems to me to be a very graceful sport.
Mm.
And it was also put to me recently by a school principal that a child who was finding difficulty with spelling would find the spelling would improve if she got into more sport.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because, so, well...
Is that an area that's being examined?
As part of the Asian Cup, there was a school resource developed that helped... It's a number of modules that helps kids understand what Asia is and the countries in Asia and the cultures and the various things that happen in those countries. And there was also a mathematics module which helped them work out scores and tables and all the other calculations of who finishes where. And I'm sure that, you know, spelling or some kind of, you know, understanding of even writing these days would be part of that as well. And that legacy is now coming forward, so it will be rebranded and still in the school space for primary schools, rebranded with A-League and W-League brands, so that's there. But, yeah, just reading would help a lot of students, I think, these days, and not short-form text.
I wonder if your Scottish parents had any idea of what their Australian-born daughter is going to end up doing.
No. That makes me a bit emotional. Because my parents are very proud of me, obviously. My father passed away 7 years ago on the eve of me being inducted into the FFA Hall of Fame. And, of course, now I have the AM. And my mother says she's bursting with pride to the extent she feels like a sausage about to burst its skin. So they're very proud.
Well, you should be very proud as well, Heather.
Thank you.
And we're very proud of you as well, as proud Canberrans. So thank you very much this morning. Fascinating talk. Please thank Heather again for a fascinating talk.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.